From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Harvey's floodwaters are displacing thousands of people. In Houston and beyond, storm victims are arriving at shelters delivered by dump trucks and rescue boats. FEMA officials say by the time it's over, more than 30,000 people may be forced from their homes. Houston's largest shelter is well beyond capacity already, with more still in need of a place to stay. Churches, gyms, even a furniture store have opened their doors. This hour on Point, seeking shelter after Harvey. You can join us on air or online. Has Harvey displaced you or a friend or a family member? Are you looking for shelter? If so, where did you go? If you've been forced out of your home, what's your long-term housing plan if you've been able to think that far ahead? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Houston is Nancy Sarnoff, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She's been reporting from the Downtown Convention Center in Houston, which is the biggest shelter in the city. Nancy Sarnoff, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me on.
I want to start us off with three back-to-back short clips, which give a sense of what's going on down there. One is from the FEMA administrator, Brock Long. This is from a press conference on Monday, and he said that, in his words, getting everybody sheltered would be a heavy lift.
We're anticipating over 30,000 people being placed in shelters temporarily to basically stabilize the situation and provide for their care.
And as we mentioned, the city's convention center is one of the places where Harvey refugees are going. 5,000-bed shelter, although I believe it's beyond that capacity already. Here's Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings yesterday.
We're going to come together and we're going to help Houston out. This is a terrible thing. As Mayor Turner said to me, you just never know what's going to happen when you deal with natural occurrences.
Even less conventional places are now housing people. Elementary schools and churches have been turned into temporary shelters. Here's Pastor David McDougall. He opened the doors of the First Baptist Church in North Houston to more than 300 people.
They're sleeping on the ground and chairs.
And people sleeping under tables. And we're trying really hard to keep everyone safe.
Nancy Sarnoff, give us a sense of the scene at the convention center.
Well, it's pretty upsetting at times. At this point, well, like you said earlier, it was initially expected to house a maximum of 5,000 people. This morning, it was up to 9,000 people. Late last night, there were people that were crafting these makeshift beds for their families with blankets, towels, you know, plastic bags, whatever they had, really. People were coming in after, you know, just being in water, standing in water for hours and hours. They'd been rescued. They were coming in. They were freezing, shivering. Their hands, their feet were swollen from being in water. A lot going on down there.
Right. I mean, you paint such a vivid scene. It's not just that people are walking through the door. They're coming through sopping wet. You know, you can just imagine mm-hmm. the water on the floor and what it must look and feel like inside that center. Do you have any idea how many actual cots or beds there are? I am certainly imagining not enough to accommodate all the 9,000 people in there.
Yeah, not enough to accommodate them. I mean, the people came in much faster than they were expected to. So I was told late yesterday that there were enough to house 5,000, but I'm not sure that's the case. I know that the Red Cross, which is running the shelter, is having trouble getting a lot of their vendor trucks in, so they're not getting supplies there as fast as they can because of the roads. So, you know, the city and Harris County have talked about opening another shelter. I'm not sure who would, another major shelter, I'm not sure who would run that shelter yet or where that would be, but hopefully today we'll know something more so people can be sent to a place where they can be helped, because this one downtown is just, you know, it's growing. They're not sending anyone away. So it's really tough down there.
Nancy Sarnoff, any sense of what the restroom situation is like at the convention center? Can it keep up with demands for people who need a bathroom, who need sinks?
Yeah, I'm sure it's getting taxed. I haven't heard this morning, but there are restrooms. The Red Cross said that they were bringing in shower trailers. I don't know if they're there yet. I highly doubt that they've arrived, but that's something that these people are going to need as the, you know, as the days go on, and the longer they stay there, they're, you know, the shelter is going to be open for as long as people need it. And so they need, you know, they're in need a lot right now. And one of the things that the city is responding, and it's one of the things the city is responding to, citizens are coming in as quickly as they can get to downtown. They're offering help to volunteer. I mean, I believe there are way more volunteers from just our residents than there are Red Cross, because Red Cross brings a lot of their people in from other places, and they haven't been able to come in. So,
yeah, you mentioned that Red Cross is having trouble getting supplies in because so many roads are impassable. What about the food situation? Is there food being supplied to people going to the convention center?
So I've heard some conflicting reports about the food situation. From what I've seen, people are eating. Yesterday, they were passing out cups of chili and hunks of bread. But then I heard that, I think it was the night before, that they ran out of hot meals and people were just being given, you know, granola bars, things like that. They are in desperate need of food, from what I understand. Actually, the Red Cross, however, told me this morning that they are serving 9,000 people 3 meals a day.
Oh, really?
That's what the Red Cross told me this morning, but I don't think 9,000 people have been there for a full 24 hours to get 3 meals a day. So I'm just not sure how that's working with the inability to get more supplies there.
Nancy Sarnoff of the Houston Chronicle, you mentioned that Houston is trying to find another large-scale place that could accommodate people. I read that there's an education center. It's called the M.O. Campbell Education Center in North Houston that's housing about 2,000 evacuees. Do you have any sense of what other large spaces there are that could be modified to accept refugees, basically storm refugees?
Well, those are the two big ones that you mentioned. Another possibility I heard yesterday, the officials were talking about NRG Park, which was used to be called Reliant Park, and before then the Astrodome area. So I think a lot of people know the Astrodome right around there. There are other convention facilities and the big football stadium. And that's not been confirmed, but I know that that's something that officials were considering. So to be honest, the Astrodome is there. It's vacant. However, I don't know if it's habitable. I don't know if that's something that they could use. But like I said, there are other convention facilities down there.
We mentioned earlier that we had seen a story today that some furniture store in Houston is accepting people. And I'm not sure if they're actually letting people sleep on whatever furniture they have, couches or beds, and they're just going to accept it as a loss, or if they're going to clear out the store. Have you heard anything about that, or about other businesses, private businesses, saying we can pitch in?
Yeah, the furniture store, that's been real interesting. It's a longtime furniture store owned by Jim McInvale. They call him Mattress Mac. He's, you know, famous for his TV ads. And I believe he's opened a couple of his big furniture stores. I'm not sure if they're moving all the furniture out. I've seen some pictures that look like the furniture has stayed, or at least some of it has stayed, so people have a place to sit. Other than that, you know, like you said, churches, schools, community centers, things are opening up, I think, pretty quickly to try and help people. And, you know, news is spreading via social media to let people know kind of, you know, where they can go and how they can help.
I can only imagine how frayed nerves must be down there, how tired and frustrated people must be. There was a Harvey victim yesterday who talked with CNN's Carol Costello, and he was saying that in his neighborhood, he feels like he does sense rising tensions.
I've seen people walking around with guns. I've seen people walking around with knives, baseball bats, all kinds of different stuff. I mean, just,
why are they doing that?
They're trying to protect themselves. I don't know if they're trying to protect themselves or if they're... I really don't know. Maybe trying to hurt somebody. I don't believe they would be trying to hurt somebody, but I guess just trying to protect ourselves from harm.
Nancy Sarnoff, have you heard anything like that or seen that, where it's a risk that it's going to become kind of a rogue situation?
No, I have not heard anything like that. In fact, you know, what I've heard and what I've seen on our website and social media is just a lot of people getting out there to help, people that own boats, pulling out their boats and, you know, trying to find and rescue people. So I haven't heard about any sort of serious violence. You know, I worry about the convention center. I worry about the shelters that get bigger and bigger with people.
Yeah, in fact, could Austin or Dallas or other parts of the state take the pressure off if people are willing to travel that far?
Yeah, definitely. And there are shelters opening up in other cities. A number of shelters have opened up in counties around Austin, in Dallas, San Antonio. I know Airbnb just this morning said that they were expanding their disaster relief program. So what they do is they try to link people with lodging that are willing to offer it free to people in need. So they're helping out that way. And I'm about to talk to a woman in Austin who's housing a family of five in her home.
Oh, good.
I know a lot of people are willing to do that.
Yeah, it's good that people are reaching out. And certainly, even if people come up with short-term plans, they're also going to need a long-term plan once they assess the damage. So this is going to be quite an ongoing disaster. That's Nancy Sarnoff, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Nancy, thanks for making time for us as you're also living through this and reporting on it. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And listeners, stay with NPR for updates on the aftermath of Harvey and the recovery effort and President Trump's visit to the region today. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a big turn now away from Harvey coverage into the world of children's literature. But stay with NPR for ongoing updates on the storm. Maybe you have memories of how fun and captivating it was as a child to read books like Green Eggs and Ham or Charlotte's Web. But how might they seem to you now as a grown-up? My guest today says we're in a golden age of children's literature and that the books of your childhood can still teach you and still touch you. Join this conversation. Let us know, what were your favorite children's books? Have you picked any of them up recently and found new meaning in them? Were you disappointed because they didn't live up to your memory, or did you find them profound in a way you hadn't realized they were when you were a kid? Bruce Handy joins me now from New York. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book, Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. You can find an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Bruce Handy, I love that you wrote this book, and welcome very much to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Sasha. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
So I've read interviews of you in which you talked about how before you had kids of your own, you didn't really think much about children's literature. And, you know, we all know that sometimes reading to a kid at night can be a good way to put them to sleep. But you have said that you found that suddenly you were actually strangely engaged in the books, and that surprised you. So tell us about that process.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I'd been an avid reader when I was a kid, yeah, it was. I hadn't really looked at kids' books or thought much about them for, I don't know, I can't do the math exactly, maybe, you know, 30, 40 years until I finally had kids of my own. And then, you know, as soon as we had, you know, my daughter, Zoe, who's now 21, but, you know, a bunch of people very generously gave us a bunch of kids' books as baby books. And suddenly I was, you know, picking up these titles, some of which I'd never, Goodnight Moon, which is, you know, has been around since the 40s, but didn't really become, you know, ubiquitous the way it is now until really the 80s. So it was a book I wasn't aware of when I was a kid, and picking up things like that, and The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which is also a book I didn't know as a kid, and just, yeah, kind of marveling at how beautiful some of these books were, and how well constructed, and how kind of, you know, surprisingly deep they were. And then, yeah, once I started actually reading, you know, when my couldn't read to them when they were infants. But when they got a little older and I started, you know, reading these books, yeah, I suddenly found that, you know, in the way that I've been sort of along, you know, and I've written some about, you know, movies and music. And, you know, I was always the kind of, you know, kid who would, you know, pick up an album and like see who was playing on it and who the producer was. I was always curious. And I started finding myself becoming more engaged in the children's book world. I mean, it was interesting. Margaret Wise Brown, the author of Goodnight Moon, and is also the author of The Runaway Bunny, which is another book, you know, a lot of people know we received early on. And yeah, suddenly it's like, wow, who is this Margaret Wise Brown? I'd never even heard of her. And I started seeking out some of her other books, which are, you know, I mean, she published, I think, 60 books in her lifetime. And, you know, there's probably a couple duds, but they're both of them pretty amazing.
What's an example of a book you went in thinking it may be kind of trite or superficial, and you came out thinking, in your words, that there was depth to it?
Well, I mean, yeah, Goodnight Moon, is a perfect example of that because, you know, on the surface, it's very, you know, simple. It's, you know, here we are in the Great Green Room, and here's what's in the Great Green Room. There's, you know, mittens and kittens and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon, and then it's goodnight mittens, goodnight kittens, goodnight cow jumping over the moon, and the little bunny baby goes to bed. But, yeah, you know, when I started, you know, reading it through several times, and as you do with children, you know, you reread these things and the great
and
books are the ones
over
that can bear rereading. And, you start seeing more into it. And I kind of realized, I mean, for me, like a real profound connection was just in that opening line in the Great Green Room, because it started reminding me of when I was a kid. And you know, the way I just remember my own bedroom when I was a kid, and it just seemed so vast and almost, you know, kind of mysterious. Like, I mean, you know, not to sound corny, but when you're that little, when you're like, you know, one or two, it's almost like a, you know, cathedral or something. And that idea of that in the Great Green Room, and it has that kind of mystery and epic. And to me, I realized, wow, she is really getting in touch with the reason this book is so successful is she really gets how kids perceive the world. And what was interesting for me is, you know, in my early 40s, when I would have been reading this, was suddenly reconnecting with myself at a much younger age through this book and through some other ones.
Bruce, we actually have a piece of that book, Goodnight Moon, being read aloud. And this is one that's narrated by Susan Sarandon.
In the Great Green Room, there was a telephone. And a red balloon. And a picture of the cow jumping over the moon.
Bruce Handy, in your book, you write that child development specialists say that infants in their first year of life basically spend their time figuring out where they end and everything else in the world begins. And you seem to think that this book kind of captures that child development piece because they're noticing, oh, look, there's a balloon, there's a telephone. Do you actually think when Margaret Wise Brown wrote that, she was thinking at that kind of scientific developmental level?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I mean, she's just a fascinating character. I mean, we could, you know, talk about her the whole time. But yeah, because she actually studied. She went to what is now called Bank Street, which was a teacher's school. But she started out wanting to be a teacher, and then actually she studied writing. I mean, of all the people I talk about in you know, my book, from, you know, Dr. Seuss to Eric Carle to E.B. White and so on, she's, I believe, the only one who actually studied writing for children. I mean, she actually got a master's degree in it. So she, you know, she did have some training and some kind of, you know, some, you know, understanding of these issues. But at the same time, I think she was just an incredibly intuitive writer. So, I mean, like a lot of really great artists in any medium, you know, there was some mix of I mean, obviously of incredible craft and a certain amount of, you know, kind of thought and self-consciousness, but then also just, you know, kind of intuitive artistry. So how that all, you know, how that all shakes out exactly, I couldn't say, but I think it's, you know, I think it's evident in her work.
Let's go to Sally calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Sally, welcome to On Point. And what children's books really do you find a lot of depth and meaning in?
Hi, Sasha. I was going to share a story about the book The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. It was a book that I loved as a child. And I had my childhood copy of the book in the nursery when our first daughter came home from the hospital. And I will never forget walking by her nursery door one evening, and my husband was in the rocking chair reading that book to her for the first time ever, and tears were just streaming down his face. He had never read it. He he didn't know anything about it, but just the impact of that book on an adult as a parent, because, you know, the book is about that sort of unconditional love. And it was just, I'll never forget that moment. It was so special. Wonderful book.
Sally, thanks for that. Bruce, before I let you comment, I want to read something you wrote in the book. You said about the Giving Tree, you said, if you boil it down, what the book is telling kids is that if you leave home, it will kill your mother. So give us a sense of your take on this book and how it compares to our caller's experience.
Well, yeah, I don't want to, I hate to, you know, I mean, I think the great thing about you know, children's books is like everybody has, you know, different feelings about them. Yeah, I mean, the Giving Tree is a book that didn't really work for me.
You actually called it inexplicably popular.
I did. You're hoisting me with my own petard. I don't want to be mean to your listeners who love this book. But yeah, no, I find it kind of manipulative. I think it's interesting too because it feels like it's a book that in some ways is more for more for parents. I think I also compare it to movies like Mildred Pierce, you know, about these self-sacrificing, you know, mothers. And the tree is feminized in the book. It's, you know, it's referred to as she. It's interesting to me too because I really love Shel Silverstein. I love his art. I think his poems, which are sort of funny and dark and, you know, kind of remind me of Roald Dahl a little bit. To me, the Giving Tree is kind of an outlier in his body of work.
Let's go to another caller. This is Bob calling from Barrington, Rhode Island. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm the current illustrator for the Paddington Bear books, and so I wanted to call in and say and put in a good word for reading children's literature as adults, because that series of books is certainly readable for both children and adults, because it was written with both in mind.
You know, you emailed this morning mentioning that you were the illustrator. I was so hoping you would call in. Normally, I would never ask a caller their last name, but because you're public, could tell us your last name so people can connect the book to you.
Oh, Allie, A-L-L-E-Y. I go by R.W. Allie because that was a mistake I made early on in my career.
What was the mistake about? What was the mistake?
Going by initials instead of just going by good old Bob.
So you are the illustrator for the Paddington Bear books. So,
right. I've been doing it for 20 years now, yeah.
So tell us, I mean, you have to sort of illustrate in a way with both adults and children in mind. So what do you think as you do your work?
Well, I was lucky enough to get to know Michael Bond, who passed away, who was the author of these books for next year will be the 60th anniversary, and he began Paddington's story when he found a small stuffed bear on the shelf at a department store one Christmas. It was the only bear remaining, and he just imagined what that bear's life would be if it was if it was a living, breathing creature sitting in a store in London without, he would need someone to adopt him. So that story began as both an observation from a child's point of view and also from an adult's point of view, because the adults had to step in to rescue the child in this case. And illustrating the books, I've done picture books and novels, and it's all about the character.
Bob, stay with us in case Bruce Handy wants to ask you anything. But Bruce, I don't recall the Paddington Bear books getting mentioned in your book. Have you read that one recently or any of those?
I haven't. Yeah, I knew those a little bit when I was a kid, but yeah, I didn't. I didn't end up writing about them. I do have a question though. I'm just curious what if the caller, and I'm sorry, I'm bad with names.
Bob.
If he was a
Bob.
Bob, I'm curious if you were a fan of the Paddington books when you were a kid. I mean, that must be, if you were, that must have been pretty cool to then be involved in something you loved as a kid.
Well, the interesting thing was that being an American, I didn't really have a lot of knowledge, and so when I was asked to illustrate the books, I had the enormous pleasure of reading the 10 novels that were extant at that time, and that was really fun to be absorbed into a character that fully.
Bob, illustrator of the Paddington Bear books, thank you very much for calling in. And let's go to Kendall calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Kendall, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. I'm so glad you're doing this show. It means a lot. I have no memory of being read to as a child, but as I grew up and started working, I've used children's books. I'm a therapist and was and a therapist and used them with adults, and also used them with adult learners who were going for their GED. And it was in all cases, it seemed to be something helpful, a bridge, getting to a memory that maybe needed to be tapped into, or it can do for adults what it also does for children, which is help people feel not so alone.
Oh, that's interesting. Especially if you're an immigrant, you're thinking about if you're, say, an immigrant learning English.
Well, and one of the really neat things about that is because I would do workshops for immigrant parents of young children. They don't feel that they have a way often to contribute to the education of their children in this country because they don't speak English. But I would show them about something called a picture walk, which is you don't have to be able to read the words on the page. You just flip through the book with your child. You make up a story about the pictures. And even the child hearing your voice in your native language helps with something called fluency, which is going to help them when they start learning English. And so it would really empower these parents that they could go into any library, pick out a children's book, just based on the pictures alone, make up a story. And that's another great thing about your guest was saying how you can read a book to a child, you know, is what feels like a million times, and it can be hard for it to stay fresh for the parent every time they're reading the book. And one of the things that I would encourage parents and children to do is read that book, but then also together to begin explore different endings for the book. And they could draw a picture about it, or they could write a few words and tuck it into the back of the book, and the child could understand, kind of have a love of literature in a way that really puts them in the center of it, too.
Kendall, thank you for that. That's a great suggestion. And Bruce Handy, I think that also raises the question, you know, our caller talked about how children's books can sometimes help adults who are learning English learn. But that puts a burden on the author not to write something so insultingly simple that it will be boring for an adult. So there's two levels of complexity going on often in children's books. Is that what you found?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's interesting that, you know, the question of, rereading, things a lot. I mean, sometimes it's just, you know, the great children's books, I mean, I think of Dr. Seuss literally as verse, but, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, poetry, and you can just, you can read them again and again, and each time you can find a different emphasis, you know, just even in the, even in the words and the way you, the way you read it and what you choose to emphasize. And then, how you kind of stop and explore the pictures. I mean, these things are, in some ways, they're really kind of wide open texts. I sometimes think of them almost like, standards like songs, you know, like Irving Berlin songs or Duke Ellington, you know, the way like a jazz singer or a jazz musician can kind of play with those things. I think, you know, readers can do that with some of these great children's books as well.
Bruce Handy,
find their own meaning in it, find their own emphasis. I love your caller's idea too, the idea of coming up with, trying to come up with different endings. Although I hope, there's so many books that are good night books. I'd hate it it might be troublesome if the kid, decided that the ending was the little bunny didn't go to bed after all. You know, the bunny decided to stay up and watch more TV or something. But anyway.
Bruce Handy, you mentioned Dr. Seuss. And in your book, you say that when you went back as an adult to read Seuss, you were surprised to find that some of his characters seemed very aggressive, this very suppressed anger or frustration. Tell us a little bit about that revelation.
Well, yeah, I had loved Dr. Seuss as a kid. I think for me, he was sort of he was almost like a gateway drug to Mad Magazine, which was also a big formative influence on me. But rereading, looking at the Cat in the Hat, and it's funny too, because, you grow up with a book, you just sort of accept it. It's almost like, the way you sort of accept your family situation. But I read it as an adult, and sometimes like, oh my God, this is a story about a home invasion. I mean, first there's this mother who leaves her kids alone in the care of a fish, which obviously you'd call child services today. And then this cat just like bursts through the door. I mean, it's, it is aggressive.
Right. Not something a 5-year-old would be thinking as he or she reads it. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Vanity Fair contributing editor Bruce Handy about his new book, Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. You can find an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. And join this conversation. Let us know if you've gotten deep meaning out of a children's book or if you've read a kid's classic lately and what you discovered. Were you let down? Did you find it very profound? And Bruce Handy, we have a number of callers who already want to weigh in, so let's go to one of them. This is Nathan calling from Shelby, North Carolina. Nathan, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
When I was a kid, I read Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, which was kind of lesser known than Treasure Island. But read it again recently and was struck by a few things. I mean, the guy's a great storyteller, Robert Louis Stevenson. But there are also like some pretty adult themes in there. I remember early in the story, before the main character is sold into slavery, his parents die. And he goes to a pirate ship, and or a slave ship, actually. But he meets another character, and there's a pretty tight camaraderie between the two, and they manage to achieve their goals by the end of the story. But much more intricate and detailed than I remembered as a kid. And also, I think the version that I read later in life was illustrated by one of the Wyeths, maybe N.C. Wyeth. So the artwork was pretty striking. I mean, his illustrations are in many versions now. And so I just wanted to share that. I thought that was kind of in line with what you guys were talking
about.
That
really is. Nathan, yeah, that really is. Thank you for that. You're so right about that, the intricacies of the plot that you only realize when you're an adult. Other examples of that, Bruce, in your experience of things you read as a kid and then when you picked it up, you thought, I had no idea that it was that complex.
Well, yeah, I mean, a classic. I read Treasure Island to my kids, and we actually got lost. There were so many like double crosses in that book. I got totally confused. But a really profound example for me was the Narnia books, especially, you know, the first one, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was read to me in second grade, and I just I loved it. It was this great, gripping, thrilling story with magic and. Heroism, and it's a wonderful book. At that time, I didn't realize that it had these very obvious Christian themes. Which then, when I reread the book, and I lied a little bit when I said I never thought about kids lit between being a kid and being an adult, because I did take a kid lit class in high school, and we read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then it became very clear to me, as a 16-year-old or whatever, that, oh my God, this is this big Christian allegory. And
you write in the book that you felt like it was religious propaganda, which at the time, as an adolescent, felt to you like a betrayal, you write.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I was, I confess I'm not a religious person. So yeah, suddenly it just felt like, this book I had loved really had this whole, this kind of ulterior motive. It was, trying to convert you to Christianity, I thought. It actually wasn't. I mean, when I did this book, I read a lot about C.S. Lewis, and his motives were more complicated than that.
But when you came back to the book yet again as an adult, you found it charming.
Oh yeah, I found it charming and very moving. I mean, one, it was much funnier than I think. I wish I could go back in time and ask myself, like, did you realize that was so funny? Because it's a very funny book. I mean, he's Lewis is, obviously a very witty writer. But yes, also, I mean, I was very moved by the Christian themes. I mean, not in the sense that by the theology, but by the sense of, it's very palpable what being a Christian means to C.S. Lewis in that book and his feelings about Jesus Christ, who's, represented in the book, as we know, by the character of Aslan, and the way he portrays Aslan as both a figure who kind of commands both love and awe, I think is very powerful. I mean, to me, it's a sort of coded betrayal of, I mean, coded portrayal of Christ, but it's to me, I think it's one of the most moving and profound expressions of religious art that I know of. I mean, in any adult art or, Bach Requiem or anything, I find it incredibly moving.
We have a caller from Norfolk, Virginia. This is Anna. Anna, welcome to On Point. And what do you think as you listen to this?
Hi, Sasha. Yeah, I especially appreciate the discussion about the Chronicles of Narnia. I adored those as a child, and I'm reading those to my children now. But I'm actually calling in with my children, Sophia and Teddy, and they requested that I mention specifically Horton Hears a Who by Dr.
They like that one.
And so, Yeah, they
I do too.
There's a refrain. There's a refrain in that where Horton says, "A person's a person, no matter how small." And Horton the elephant is protecting this little speck of dust that has a whole civilization living on it. And I think my kids, enjoy the story and the rhythms and all that, and they appreciate the idea that they're people, even though they're small. But as an adult, it speaks to me a lot about social justice and current issues. There's a part where the Whos have to all join together to make their voices heard so that they won't be destroyed. And I think that that's really interesting. It still speaks to me now as an adult.
Anna, do you think your kids actually get that subtle message at their age?
I don't know how much they get into it, and I try not to lecture or expound too much on the story beyond their level. I think that they definitely get the idea of fairness, and they know that because they're small, they're not allowed to do all the things that adults can do. So there's an element of that.
Anna, thank you for that. That's a wonderful observation. Bruce Handy, on that theme, I want to read part of what a listener wrote on our website. The listener writes that children's books reveal important components of a worldview that we would like to impart to our children. Wonder, safety, adventure, honesty, nobility, challenges, resolution. I really like that. And it made me think of Charlotte's Web, which you write about. And here's a little piece of the author, E.B. White, reading from his book, Charlotte's Web.
The fairgrounds were soon deserted. The sheds and buildings were empty and forlorn. The infield was littered with bottles and trash. Nobody of the hundreds of people that had visited the fair knew that a gray spider had played the most important part of all. No one was with her when she died.
You know, I think many adults weep when they read that. What was your reaction?
I'm literally, if you could see me, I'm actually like a little misty-eyed just listening to it. It's interesting. I read the audiobook version. I recorded the audiobook version of my book, and when I quote that passage also in Wild Things, and I broke down, like, I think at least three times trying to read it. You know, I had a very nice recording engineer who let me do multiple takes. And apparently, as I understand it, I wish I had known this when I was writing the book. I would have included it. But apparently, it took E.B. White 17 takes to get through that passage. But yeah, no, I mean, what an incredibly moving and rich book. I mean, all the things that the reader wrote in, I think, are so true in that book. I mean, it's obviously and famously a book about death, and it expresses the whole kind of circle of life idea, I think, very, very movingly and creatively in the story of Charlotte and dying and her children who live on with Wilbur. But, you know,
line where you say it teaches us what it means to live a good life and then how to face death with grace.
Well, yeah, exactly, because it really is also, I mean, it's about friendship. It's about how to live. It's about how to accept people. I mean, there's a great passage where when Wilbur first meets Charlotte and she explains, that she basically sucks blood out of flies. That's how she eats. And Wilbur is really taken aback. There's this great line. I'm probably going to mangle it, but it's something like, he was a little perturbed that his new friend was so bloodthirsty, but he accepts her. You know, that's part, and all these different creatures in the barn, they all accept each other. They all, even Templeton the rat, who's kind of, he's out for himself, but, he plays a heroic role at the end to save. I'm getting choked up just talking about it.
Let's go to another caller. This is Sarah calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I just wanted to state that I recently had brain surgery, maybe about close to 2 years ago. And I've been actually using children's books alongside with my mom as a source of therapy to help me with reading comprehension. As an adult, and things like Dr. Seuss books, Green Eggs and Ham, Hop on Pop, and so forth.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So it's been very therapeutic for you.
It really has, yes. Like the basically going back to reading and learning vocabulary, excuse me, and so forth. And this really has been helpful in learning my reading comprehension again.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Now we've heard two wonderful examples of what else children's literature can do. Help people coming back from a head injury, a brain surgery. We've also heard about it can help adult learners learn. That's wonderful. Let's go to another caller. This is Lisa from Kinsman, Ohio. Lisa, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Sasha. Thanks for having me. Candace, when she was little, which is my niece, I used to read her this set of books called Serendipity. It had moral story, moral things at the end of it. But the one she liked the best was called Grandpa Lop. It was about a long-eared Lop rabbit. Well, I'd read to her, and I'd change the voices in the book, you know, to match the characters and everything. Well, one day I was going away, and she wanted to read the book. And I told her, well, have Grandpa read it, which would have been my dad. So she climbs up in his lap, and he starts to read it, and he didn't know how any of the voices went or anything. She's sitting there, and she says, no, Papa, let me read it to you. And she changed all the voices just like I did when I read it to her.
That's a great story.
She's 33 now, and she has two young kids of her own. And Truett, the oldest one, he calls me on the phone, and he says, Aunt Lee, read me Grandpa Lop. I need to go take a nap.
Lisa, that's really great. Thank you for that story. You know, Bruce Handy, it's reminding me of another funny story. You write about the book Bedtime for Francis. And it's this little badger doing everything she can to avoid going to bed, just like little kids do. You know, she wants a doll. She wants a piggyback ride. She wants a teddy bear. She wants kisses. She claims to see a tiger. But, you know, we've been talking a lot about what kids can learn. But you say that that book is also a de facto parenting guide. You know, it's sort of like parents can be on to kids' manipulation and figure out what to do with the kid who keeps coming up with reasons for wanting to stay awake. Tell us about that realization you had.
Well, yeah, I mean, I instantly took the book. Russell Hoban, who wrote it, he's very dry and funny. And in some ways, especially it's true, I think, of all the Francis books. There's six of them all together, but especially Bedtime for Francis is the first one. In some ways, also like The Giving Tree, it's one of the rare children's books that in some ways really from the parents, perspective. I think it's, there's a great line where, Francis says, yeah, she thinks there's a tiger in her room. And the father said, well, did the tiger eat you? And she goes, no. And then he goes, well, then it's a friendly tiger. So don't worry, go back to bed. But it's just that idea of kind of, they treat her with respect. She's a very, Francis is a very lively, imaginative kid, like a lot of real kids and a lot of kids in children's books. And the parents give her room, for that, but at the same time kind of trying to steer her a little bit. I think I use the phrase, I kind of think of them more as, not helicopter parents, but kind of tugboat parents. They're always just kind of, nudging her, but being there, nudging her where they want her to go, but being very careful not to, to squelch her spirit at all.
Let's take another caller. This is Alice calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Alice, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. What do you think as you listen to this?
Well, I want to tell you guys a story about a road trip that my sister and I took this summer to visit all the places where the Laura Ingalls Wilder little house took place.
Yeah.
And we, of course, reread all those books to get ready for our trip. It was incredibly powerful to see the places that Laura wrote about, to understand the homestead and pioneer experience from an adult perspective, to see these places that we had loved so much as little girls. It was amazing. And when you talk about looking at these books as an adult, when I was a child, I didn't understand, of course, that this land was not necessarily the Ingalls land for the taking. So you have to come at it with that lens too. But it was really a wonderful trip to see these places.
That's great. And those books were
really
powerful enough to you, exactly, to make you want to go and see them. That's really wonderful. Alice, thank you for that. Bruce, one thing you mentioned in your book that was this interesting sort of footnote of sorts that I didn't know is that you say that apparently there are many well-known authors of children's books that did not have children of their own. But yet they still had this great understanding of children's feelings and viewpoints. Is there not sort of a requirement to be able to write for a child to have had children or have a real understanding of them?
Well, that was interesting. That was really a surprise to me. I mean, certainly, Margaret Wise Brown didn't have kids. Dr. Seuss didn't have kids. Maurice Sendak didn't have kids. Many others. C.S. Lewis didn't have kids. I think what's interesting to me about it, I think it really shows that a lot of these people, and Dr. Seuss and Maurice Sendak said this, very explicitly in interviews, that they were really writing for themselves. And I think like a lot of great artists, again, in any medium, I keep coming back to this, but they just had something they needed to express, and happily for them, they found their medium, and happily for us, it happened to be children's books. You know, it's just what they needed to say. Ezra Jack Keats is another one writer and illustrator who didn't have kids. It's just, you know, I think it speaks to what, in some ways, what makes these books so great is the fact that they weren't writing for kids specifically. I mean, they obviously had an idea of a market and stuff, but as I said, they were really just writing for themselves.
Another thing you write is that part of the reason as adults we see children's books differently is that, and in your words, the older you get, the more you see. But that's not always the case, right? We tend to no longer notice simple things, and we tend to lose our sense of wonderment as we get older. Do you feel like children's books have the potential to re-energize that sense of wonderment?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, yeah, like I was sort of saying with Goodnight Moon Again, I mean, that really put me back in touch with my, you know, 1 or 2 year old self and that sense of wonder. I think, Charlotte's Web is another great example of that. I mean, again, it gives you just that appreciation for living life and just the scope of that and the scope of a life. I think absolutely, 100%.
That's Bruce Handy, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of Wild Things, The Joy of Reading's Children's Literature as an Adult. You can find an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Bruce, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.